Welcome to the Playbook. It's a podcast where we get under the hood of people who are building some really impactful products, companies. And today I'm really excited to be recording this podcast with Samir Bodas, who is the co-founder and CEO of iCertis. Samir, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Pankaj. Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. You know, Samir, I will be honest with you. It's only recently that I started hearing about iCertis. And one of the VCs actually in the Indian ecosystem one day called me and asked me if I have heard of a company called iCertis. I had not. And then he said, it's already a unicorn. How can you not know about it? I mean, so you know, FOMO applies to all of them.
That's right.
And so that's how I discovered, I'll be honest, and been trying to have this conversation. So welcome back again, Samir.
No, great to be here. Thank you for having me. And hopefully by the end of this conversation, you'll no longer have any FOMO.
Absolutely. Let's start from the start, Samir. Tell me a bit about yourself. Where do you come from? Give me a sense of growing up, and then we will get into business.
So I'm Maharashtrian, but I'm not entirely sure if you can pin me down from any one city or area, because I grew up in Delhi till sixth standard, went to DPS Mathura Road, and then my father's an airline pilot, now he's retired. We moved to Malaysia for 2 years and we lived there. In fact, I used to speak Malay when we lived in Malaysia. I learned Malay there. And then from 7th standard through 12th, I was in Pune. And then from 12th, after my undergraduate, I came to the U.S. So I guess I've lived in the U.S. longer than I have lived in India. I came here when I was 17, and I'm 55 now. So when people ask me where I'm from, you know, I can say Delhi, I can say Pune. I guess the longest I've lived anywhere in the world is Seattle, Washington. So I'm from, you know, the Pacific Northwest here in the United States. So that's really my background. And as I like to say, you know, I am your classic Indian-born confused Desis. Because I was born in India, I live in the U.S., I'm American of Indian heritage now. And you know, it's very obvious that I'm from India. And when I go to when I'm traveling outside of India, and when I go back to India, they say, "Oh, you sound like an American." So go figure. You know, the trials and tribulations of a first generation immigrant.
Okay, that's quite a journey, Samir. help me understand the entrepreneurial stint. I mean, iCertis the first company you built?
Yeah, this is the first company I am a co-founder of. But just to sort of share a little bit about my educational and professional journey quickly. So I came to the U.S. to do my undergrad in computer science. I did that from the University of Texas at Austin. Then I worked at a program of 5 years, got my MBA in 92. And then I was in Microsoft for almost 8 years, which were sort of very formative years for me, just learning about business, learning what it takes to build such a fantastic company. And the company was small enough when I joined, where you know, I had the opportunity to present to Bill Gates and to Steve Ballmer, and sort of really observe them as to how they ask questions, how they think about business problems, and really learned just so much in those 8 years. And since 2000, I've been doing startups. The first couple of startups I worked for, as an early employee, but not a founder, they didn't go anywhere. The third startup, I became the CEO of a company called Disha Technologies, which is a software testing services company, sort of based out of India, but having a presence in the US. I came on board, and then we sold that in 2004 to a company called Aztecsoft, which is actually Bangalore based. to the public limited company trading on the Indian stock exchanges. I became the CEO of that company in 2006, and then we sold Astix out in 2009 to Mindtree. And you know, I think Mindtree now has been acquired by L&T Infotech, or L&T, I should say. And then we founded iCertis in 2009. So you know, I've been in, before founding iCertis, I was in startups or smaller companies for the previous 8 years. But iCertis is the first company I founded. Actually, I co-founded with Monish Monish Darda, who is our CTO and co-founder.
Awesome. So let us now get you know gain a deeper understanding of iCertis itself, you know, and try and understand the core building blocks of iCertis from idea to different life stages, Sameer. Now, give me a sense of the context, the environment in which this idea came by, and what was the idea like? Take me through those very early days, weeks, months.
Yeah. I think we are a very unconventional unicorn, I would say, because where we find ourselves today, the way sort of I would describe it is just because of a series of serendipitous events. You know, there was neither Monish nor I, you know, jumped out of a bathtub, say, Eureka, we'll build a contract management company. But sort of we backed into this opportunity really out of some focus, some execution, but definitely a substantial amount of luck. So let me sort of take you back to 2009. And how this happened. So when we sold, or I sold, or I was part of Astixsoft, and we sold the company Astixsoft to Mindtree, I exited that integration and really was at a crossroads whether I should sort of retire or sort of do something else or keep working. Monish just so happened to be at a similar crossroads. He was at a company called DataLogic, which they sold to BMC in around the same time, 2008, 2009. And he exited that acquisition, that integration in 2009. And he was wondering what to do next after that DataLogic journey. And we sort of thought about it, and our wives actually said, you know, no way will you ever retire. You know, if you retire and stay at home, then I'm going to go work. and there's lots of things. Their kids were younger, and you know, our wives have left their jobs when we had our kids, and you know, we wanted a role model for the kids. You know, sitting at home and doing nothing. We thought probably at that age is not a good idea. They were young then, so we started sort of iCertis, Monish and I, and we know each other for over a decade as friends. Just because we had to work, just professionally stay engaged. And when you have been at startups for a while, you are reasonably unemployable by a large company. Because, see, what happens is, you know, you're too entrepreneurial, you're too free-spirited, and though larger companies would like to tap into that entrepreneurship and free spirit, the nature, they also want to keep you on some within some bumpers and within some bounds. And entrepreneurs sort of find it hard sometimes to stay within those bounds. And you know, you're not that employable by a large company. So the best thing to do when you sort of sold your company or sort of the company is to the next thing is really just start another company. So we started iCertis really to have some professional engagement. However, we did know that we will, you know, start this company we will have what we would want it to be a software product company, because that's sort of the area that we had deep experience in and expertise in. And we always knew that to build a large, successful software company, you either have to create a technology wave or ride a technology wave. Creating a technology wave and to build a software company on that is hard. In fact, it is really only for very special people like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and the like, Elon Musk, or sort of just different human beings. So really, the only option we had was to ride a technology wave. At any one time, if you think about it, there are lots of technology waves going. Even if you think about it today, if somebody wants to do a startup, they could ride the AI, ML technology wave. They could ride the sharing economy technology wave, the autonomous stuff technology wave, and on and on and on. There's just so many waves. So which wave do you ride if you want to build a software company that you hope will be large one day? Even in 2009, 2010, 2011, there are lots of technology waves going at that time. There was the social technology wave. Facebook was not, that big at that time. There was mobile commerce was a big thing, and a bunch of others. But the first serendipitous event that we have is, I live here in Seattle, Washington, and it just so happened that in that era, that time period, two of the four biggest clouds in the world were being developed here in Seattle. And the cloud wave was really coming on. And we really saw that investment coming very early because Amazon was investing a lot in its cloud. Microsoft was investing a lot in its cloud. Microsoft Cloud, the code name of Azure at that time was Red Dog. They really hadn't even named Azure yet, and we saw this wave coming, and we essentially said, "Wow, if these two companies are going to invest so much money in this wave, man, it could be really big if it's successful." And if we'll get a small sliver from a percentage perspective of that wave when it hits, and if this wave is that big, we have a big opportunity to build a big company. So we actually, at a very early stage, bet the company on building a product in the cloud. We still don't have a product. And really, the second sort of serendipitous event was how we sort of backed into the contract management opportunity. What we were thinking was, we will build software, a product that will necessarily move to the cloud. Because that time in 2010, 2011, it was not obvious what software will move to the cloud. And we said, hey, looks like software that sits on the edge of the enterprise, that communicates with customers, that communicates with partners, distributors, consumers, et cetera, that is probably the software that will move to the cloud, because that software already has some security surface exposed externally from the enterprise. And also, it sort of the demand goes up and down over a period of time. And we said, well, it looks like that kind of software is what will move to the cloud. And we are enterprise software people, so we never looked at B2C. And we still don't have a product. But the second serendipitous event was at a cocktail party where a bunch of Microsoft people were there, and some of them were quite senior. And one of them asked me, Samir, what are you doing next? And I told him that, hey, we are thinking of building a software company in the cloud, on the edge, any software that interfaces with customers and partners and distributors and consumers, et cetera. And he said, oh, wow, that's interesting. Why don't you think of building a contract management software? And I said, really? I said, contract management software, what is that? I know what contract is. I know what management is. But isn't that all done by legal folks? Why do you need software for it? And he sort of explained to me what that is and that Microsoft was looking for a solution like that. They couldn't find anything in the market. The reason was sort of a myriad, but really netting out was most of the software that was available then in market for contract management was either too wide but shallow, or too deep but narrow. What he was trying to say was the software was, you know, did the whole enterprise end-to-end business process, so it was wide, but it was shallow in the sense that it was not enterprise class. And the other software that was enterprise class, which was deep but narrow in the sense it didn't do end-to-end contract management business process. So he said, hey, here is, you know, a RFP, build the software. If you like it, we'll license it. The only requirement is that it has to be in the Microsoft cloud. And we went back, we thought about it. We said, hey, it's in the cloud. It's an edge product that, you know, communicates with partners and customers and vendors, et cetera. And it's going to be obviously sort of the right space for us. And if we build it right, Microsoft will license it and we'll have our first customer. And we grabbed that serendipitous opportunity and ran with it. And that's really how sort of the company got going. It's a sort of longer story about how we sort of had to get the product market fit done, how we had to figure out how, you know, what to build with respect to features, et cetera, and then all the financing. But I'm sure we'll get into that later in the podcast.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think what I liked in particular listening to this part, Sameer, is the way you talked about the validation. But that brings me to another question. So great, you got validation from the world's biggest software company talking about a problem. And then you also talked about it being for Microsoft Cloud. Now, how did you ensure that, you know, you are building a product or a company which is beyond that, or what did you do after that validation?
No, that's a great question. So the journey started. We built a product, and one of the most fundamental decisions we made, which is, you know, paid out in spades, is that we said, hey, really, since it is a product that will be used for a business process that is so core to the enterprise, it will have to sort of sit with a lot of other systems around it. And whatever we do, we should build a platform which can work with all sorts of other systems around it and probably can be enhanced into the future. Then just build a monolithic product that can be used by a bunch of customers or what have you as standalone. So the first sort of decision, really, it was, you know, full credit to Monish to think about this, is that we actually didn't build a product, we built a platform. Because we knew we'll have to extend it and expand it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's very important point you are making, because we have seen a lot of products taking the platform route later, right? You are saying you took a decision to start with the platform itself. Can you help me understand that deeper? Because a lot of entrepreneurs kind of struggle with that choice.
Yeah. So I'll let you in on a little secret. When we first got into the contract management sort of space, we didn't think the category was that big. We didn't think we'll be able to build a company more than, you know, $20, $25 million company. And that was not good enough for us. So we said, hey, we probably will build 4 or 5 products in the cloud on the edge. And each of them will probably get us $20, $25 million and we'll have a $100 million company. And we will sell that company and move on. So to build a, you know, multiple products, really, you have to build a platform on which the products can be built. So really, that's how this platform idea came about, where Moni said, hey, let's build something so that we can extend it. Not only just the contract management product, we can build many other products on it. And we can have a suite of ERPs around cloud products. That was the original thinking. And actually, we did build a bunch of products. But the contract management product took off. And we then took everything else that was non-contract management and spun it out into a company called CloudMoyo, which still exists. And they are in completely different area like transportation and analytics and things like that. And then we took this platform on which was built the contract management product and took it to market. And we have this now, just serendipitously, you know, luckily because of the history of the company, a product that is a platform that really can do almost anything a large or any type of customer wants to do in contract management, because it built so flexibly. And you can really build anything on it, because it thinks about, you know, from a technical perspective, it doesn't think of the object as a contract, but it thinks about the object as an entity. And I'm getting a little bit technical here, because the way it is designed is to not think of solving just the contract management problem, but any generic workflow problem, any generic integration problem, any generic entity creation problem, et cetera, et cetera. And we have taken that power and applied it to one category, contract management. And that's why we are one of the most powerful platforms out there in this category.
Fascinating again, Sameer. Just before we get into the core building blocks of the product itself, one more question about when you decided to go after contract management as a product in this space, what were the signals? You know, how did you pick that? What were the signals that you picked?
That's a fantastic question, because, you know, and we had a little bit tricky situation because we had multiple products that we had built. We had built a transportation product related to fleet management, related to public transport management. We built a bunch of products. What happened was that in 2014, the contract management product took off, where, you know, we closed a bunch of marquee customers. We closed ABB as a customer. We closed Airtel as a customer in India. We closed Genpact. We closed Johnson & Johnson. And that we could see that traction. And the question then became, hey, if this particular product is getting traction and the product market fit was apparent, because the large companies were betting their contracting business process on little iService. And if a large company comes to you and says, hey, I want to license your product, when there are so many options, you must be having a pretty good solution that is solving a pretty hard problem. And when you saw this sort of product market fit, the real question is now, do we go for it? In other words, do we go raise money? Or do we still continue to sort of sniff around to figure out whether our mousetrap is really that good before we go for it in the contract management category? And again, here's another lucky twist that we've had. My hiring manager at Microsoft, his name is Pradeep Singh. In fact, he actually was the founder of Aditi Technology. Yeah. Yeah, so he hired me into Microsoft, and he's a good friend of mine. And he was sort of, you know, we go on walks and talk a lot. He was asking me, Sameer, what are you doing nowadays? And I told him about contract management and all these other products, and contract management is sort of taking off. We closed all these customers. And you know, he was so right when he said this. He said, Sameer, you're an idiot. I said, okay, Pradeep, you said that before to me. Why am I an idiot this time? And he said, look, you're not a Microsoft. You're not going to be able to have the dollars to build 4 or 5 products. The R&D expense is too high. The go-to-market methodology playbook is different. You know, the buyer is different, et cetera, et cetera. Pick one product and go for it. Go raise money and give it your all and see what happens. Because if you go for multiple products and don't focus, which is sort of essentially sort of a core of what an entrepreneur, I believe, must do is focus. If you don't focus, you're neither going to be fish nor fowl and you'll fail. And I kind of listened to him, but you know, he's a very convincing guy. He's a very fertile mind too. So he really pushed me hard, and I talked to Monish. And we said, okay, let's try it. So we put actually let's try raising some money for the contract management product. So we put a pitch deck together in October of 2014, and we just socialized it with some VCs. And it just so happened that in 3 weeks, we got 3 term sheets. And we said, wow, this is interesting. these VCs, by the way, the good thing the VCs do, or the good thing the good VCs do, is that they sort of look at very successful companies and they sort of play back or take those companies back to when they were Series A or Series B, and they try to find patterns of, you know, the product, the management team, the competitive landscape, the total addressable market, the pricing model, you know, business model, et cetera, et cetera. And when they see a match, they invest. And of course, they invest in tens of these companies, and two of them, sort of, or five of them work out, and they make a lot of money. But they're very good at pattern matching. And we said, hey, they must have seen something in us that is so special that they've so quickly, three of them jumped on it and gave us term sheets. So we must be having some sort of a winner on our hands. And we sort of thought about it, and we said, all right, let's go for it. Because two of the VCs were, you know, extremely strong. It was, one was Fidelity. They're called Eight Roads now in India. You might know them. One of the, you know, best in India. And Greycroft, which is based in New York, which is one of the best VCs here in the US. They said, hey, if these two guys want to invest in us, and they see the sort of commonality between who we are and large companies that they've seen be successful, let's take the money and run like crazy. And we closed that round in March. We sort of spun out CloudMoyo, and we raised $6 million in 2015 March. And every year since then, we have raised money. And right now, you know, we've raised in primary capital $175 million. You know, we have 1,000 employees, and as you said, we are, you know, worth more than $1 billion in our last round.
Okay, great. Now, Samir, let's spend some time on the product itself. Take me through the core building blocks of the product journey, hits and misses, and you know, the deepest learnings, you know, on that product journey when you picked contract management. Take me through that journey. Spend some time on that.
So let's sort of give a very quick course on contract management, but I think not many people are familiar with it. So think about sort of a very large company, take, you know, Microsoft or Boeing or what have you, right? In any large company, there are three large buckets of contracts. And, you know, every dollar into the company and every dollar out of the company is governed by contract, right? So anything they buy, which is one large bucket of stuff, of contracts, is actually sort of governed by what are called buy-side contracts or procurement contracts. That's one bucket. The second bucket is anything that companies sell, right? There are contracts related to what they sell, whether it's a plane or software or a service or a pharmaceutical, you know, the contracts that sort of govern selling those products and services. And that's the second bucket of contracts that are there in enterprise, and those are called sell-side contracts. And then the third bucket is what are called corporate contracts. Corporate contracts are anything that are not necessarily commercial in value, non-disclosure agreements, memorandums of understanding, employment agreements, M&A agreements, et cetera, et cetera. So there are three large buckets. Now, a contract management system is something that, or a piece of software that helps you manage all these contracts so that you can reduce costs, you can increase revenue, you can improve cash flow, or you can manage your risk better. That's what contract management system does. And what the approach that we took, which was very different than most of the vendors or suppliers in the category even today, is that we said that historically, contract management systems have been designed to manage only buy-side contracts or only sell-side contracts, only corporate contracts. There's no system that has been built that is used to manage all contracts for the company. So for example, an ERP system, you don't have a cost accounting system, which is different from a revenue accounting system. It's just one financial accounting system. So we believe that you needed a contract management system to manage all your contracts, what we call enterprise contract management. And we were the first ones to coin that phrase, enterprise contact management, where you use a system that is in the cloud that helps you manage all your contacts around the world so that you can essentially correlate different deals that you're doing, correlate different types of customers and in different geographies, and you know, do contracting in a much more optimal way so that, you know, as I said, increase revenue, reduce costs, improve your cash flow and manage your risk better. And that's our sort of fundamental idea. So building block was an enterprise contract management system that did this end-to-end for all your contracts. The second thing, since we are a platform, is we build apps on top of this contract management platform. That we build apps to solve specific problems for the customer, where, you know, with related to contracts. So you might have a problem related to obligations management of your commitments and entitlements that you have in your contract. So we have an obligation management app. We have an app related to rebates management, the contracts related to rebates and incentives. And we have an app related to that. We have an app related to making sure how you manage your clinical trials, which have agreements or contracts related to that. So what we have been able to do is build a platform that manages all your contracts across the board and then have apps on top, including, you know, a sourcing app that will help you manage specific types of contracts that need specific optimization. And that's what calls out the app layer. And then on top of that, what we have, what is called the experience layer. And the experience layer is where we express the power of our platform in the end user's app of choice. So, for example, if a salesperson wants to create a contract, he or she really wants to do it from a CRM system. And so they want to do it from a, you know, dynamic CRM or from Salesforce or what have you. And what we do is we sort of meet the user in that app. So they don't have to switch context. Or if you are a HR user or a procurement user, you might use Workday, and we meet the user in Workday. And what the reason we did that is, and this is another interesting learning, is that if you make the user switch apps, so you do your, you know, CRM or customer relationship management one app and contract management in another, as opposed to the contract management app shows up in the CRM system, or if you're a procurement person, you do your sourcing in one app and your contract management in another, as opposed to the contract management showing up in the sourcing app, the drop off in adoption if you have two different apps is about 40%. And we didn't want adoption to drop off so dramatically. So we built this experiences layer where we express the power of the platform in Workday, in Salesforce.com, in Microsoft Dynamics CRM, in Teams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so that, you know, these end users, which might be a procurement person or a salesperson or a compliance person or a risk person or a financial CFO or, you know, in the finance department, they can use any apps they want, and then we show up in their app so that they don't have to switch out. Of course, a lot of people prefer our UI, and we are fine with that too. But this way, the platform can be used by everybody in the company, and we have the same governance and the same technology, but they don't have to leave the apps that they enjoy being in on a day-to-day basis and do their contract management along with their core job.
Mm-hmm. If I can interrupt you, Sameer, on the product journey itself, how do you decide what features to keep and what not? The reason I'm asking is, so when you're working very closely with a set of customers, that is one, right? So there is a wish list. Then people who are building the product, they have their own way of looking at what problems it should solve or what features, you know, nice to have, good to have, trying to prove, you know, creativity and so on. I'm trying to understand, how do you decide on what features to keep and what not? And is it an ongoing battle? How does that work?
No, it's a fantastic question. And I think I have a very simple answer. Follow the money. That means listen to the customer. And especially in a category like ours, where you know it's used by very large customers, and our essentially target market is the global 5,000. The problem is kind of known. And you are going to give a solution to the problem they're going to articulate. So listen to your customer and prioritize everything that the customer has asked for on top of what you think is a great idea. Number one thing to do with respect to feature prioritization, you've got to follow the money. That means you've got to follow what the customer is asking for. The place where you might want to substantially innovate is when there is an inflection in technology. So for example, where do we spend a lot of money innovating as opposed to following the customer? It's in places like blockchain. Because there's such new technology that people haven't figured out what to do with it. And we are innovating to show them how to use blockchain in contract management or AIML, right? This is the first time in the history of the world that you're taking sort of contracts which are on mostly on pieces of paper and digitizing them, where you can then look into that document and figure out what is actually written and what is the meaning of a clause or a provision that is in the contract. And using AIML, you can then make decisions. This has never been done in the history of the world. And when you have these technologies that are extremely disruptive, that can be applied in ways that the customer really has not experienced before, innovate. If you can disrupt, innovate. If there's inflection, innovate. If it is solving problem, follow the customer. He or she will tell you what his or her problem is. You give them a better mousetrap, they will buy from you.
Great, great. So, okay, let's go back to the product life stages question that we were discussing. Now, if you were to handpick 2-3 important milestones that were defining for the product itself, what would be they? And also touch upon some of the mistakes that you made while building the product and the learnings.
I think that's a great question. So the thinking about it, the platform was very, very fundamental. We talked about it earlier in the podcast, right? And the reason that was so pivotal is really we have taken a platform that was designed to build any app that you might want, and we are applying it just to solve problem in one category. And no other product has that flexibility that we have, because they're not designed for that. Most products are designed to solve a specific issue that the vendor might realize that a customer has, but has not been able to anticipate what other problems they might be able to solve in the future. And therefore, they're sort of constrained by their design. But if you start with a platform, you're not constrained by anything, because the platform can really be a fungible and be applied to any business problem. So that was the first very, very critical decision that has paid out in spades. Second is going with Microsoft Azure. Microsoft has been a fantastic partner for us. It is one of those companies that is so partner friendly, and really sells only with partners, that betting on Azure, which is a fantastic platform, and partnering with Microsoft in going to market has been phenomenally positive, and probably one of the best bets that we made. And especially for a smaller company to ride the coattails of such a big company that is partner friendly, especially in the enterprise. If you're going to sell to the enterprise, the company that knows enterprise is really Microsoft. 100% of enterprises in the world, 99% of enterprises in the world probably have some Microsoft software in the enterprise. And Microsoft knows how to sell to these enterprises, and just partnering with them, you will go so far if your target is to send to enterprises. So I think that was a very, 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 very pivotal decision for us that has, again, paid back substantially. Turning to mistakes, you know, there's so many, I think sort of in all sorts of places, there have been sort of design decisions that we wish we hadn't made. There's some hires that we wish hadn't made. There's some deals that I have made, I will accept, that I wish I hadn't made, where I gave the software too cheap. And of course, our head of sales now reminds me about, you know, those deals whenever we are in tricky situations. In any business building, you're going to definitely make mistakes. The question is not whether you will make mistakes, how you react to them to be more resilient. And I think in each of these sort of mistakes that we have made, we have learned from it. We have been resilient. We have tried to not make that mistake again. And we have sort of kept on moving forward. And that's really a big learning for any entrepreneur. You're fallible. You're not infallible. So don't brood about the mistakes you make, because you're designed to make mistakes. What you are trying to figure out is, how do I learn from this mistake, don't make it again, and grow from it, as opposed to get buried by it.
And Samir, now in hindsight, if you were to look back at some of the mistakes, and you rightly said that the learning is more important than brooding itself. Now, if you were to pick the biggest learnings across design or sales or hiring, what would be your do and don't in hindsight, of course?
Yeah. So I would say the biggest do's is focus on the culture of the company. When you build a company, when you are the founder of the company, the whole company is looking to you to answer the question, why do we do what we do? What are the core values of why do we do what we do? And what is our culture that we'll build on those values? You know, culture is an enunciation of your values. So that it gives them a direction as you go bigger and bigger to make business decisions, and business, or it could be personnel decisions. It could be all sorts of decisions related to a broad area of things where people are making these decisions and need guidance without sort of talking to founders or talking to senior people. And the values and the culture of the company are really those guideposts. Those beacons that is so important to have and to nurture. And as you grow, make sure that you don't lose them. One of the things that we worry about, Monish and I, that as you get more and more successful, how will we stay grounded in who we are? How do we do that? How does a company, you know, we are 1,000 people, where we have employees around the world who have come from different cultures, you know, from different countries, different professional cultures, how do we keep bringing them in so that they embrace our culture, they enhance it, and then they amplify it, and that culture stays grounded in the values? I think that is one of, if you ask me what is the biggest risk that we worry about, is that if we lose that, then you never know what the side effects of that will be in business decisions, in customer interactions, in, you know, employee interaction, community interactions, and how you can go awry. But that is one thing that think hard about. It's a hard thing to think about, but it's very important to think hard about it. Because it the implications are substantial and long-term if you don't get your values definition right and if you don't get your culture set right.
The other thing, Samir, is on hiring itself. Now, at different life stages, again, you have early employees who take the leap of faith to come and work with you on the business product side and all of that. But as you grow as a product, as you grow as a company, the life stages keep changing. So So what is your biggest learning on hiring, on people?
So one of the things that we do, which I highly recommend everybody does, is that we have two parts of the interview. One part is sort of more technical, if you want to call it, you know, can you sell? Can you develop? Can you market? Can you do finance? And then there is a very specific part of the interview, which is called the values fit interview. And I'll give a little joke. Have you seen the movie Sholay?
Of course.
Okay. So I'll give you, there's a scene in Sholay where Jay and Veeru come to the village. And when they come to the village, Thakur sort of stay in this outhouse or one of the houses outside. And they're attacked by some gundas.
Yes.
And they thrash those gundas. And, you know, Thakur shows up and they ask Thakur, who are these people? And he said, hey, they were my people. And so they say, hey, then why did they attack me? And in Hindi, Thakur says, क्योंकि मैं देखना चाहता था कि वक्त की दीमक ने तुम्हारे बाजू खोखले तो नहीं कर दिए. That means, has time emptied your, essentially, your emptied you out of your strength. So that was Thakur's sort of values as well as technical test. And we give that values test to our employees, where we put them in certain very specific, you know, situations where we try to figure out how do they address certain issues that might not be binary in nature, that are gray, and you really have to apply your judgment and who you believe you are to solve those problems. And those case studies sort of give us insight into whether there's a values fit between that individual and us. And we actually take that, even if you are technically superb, if you don't cut it on the values test, we actually don't make an offer.
Wow. This is fascinating, Sameer. We all love Sholay, but applying lessons from there, in amazing. Really nice. Really nice. A final couple of questions. Now, as an entrepreneur, as a CEO, how do you ensure that you are not drinking your own Kool-Aid? And what I mean is that people talk about entrepreneurial optimism, right? Which is very undying. Like, I'm a failed startup founder, rookie myself, right? So how do you ensure that you are not on some wild goose chase? How do you ensure that the entrepreneurial optimism doesn't overwhelm you? I mean, how do you do that? How do you stay sane, actually?
Yeah. No. So first of all, you know, I tell you personally for me, and then we expand it. You know, I have teenage kids now, and they keep my ego in check. And yeah, I'll tell you, for example, my daughter, when she's much older now, when she was 13 or 14, or 12 or 13, we were having this discussion and she just couldn't agree with what I was saying in a debate. And she goes, Dad, how come you are so successful when you're so stupid? And I said, okay. So in the bonus family, people don't have egos because you will be taken down. The other thing is, you know, I think just be very open with your team and be very introspective about yourself. I'll share a personal example, if I may. Late last year, I was actually diagnosed with cancer. And, you know, I went through treatment. It's not a serious cancer, but have to go through treatment. And the first, you know, I was in treatment for 6 weeks and I didn't come to work for a quarter. And I sort of in the second quarter of this year, I was there part-time. And of course, I'm here full-time. While I was not at work, I was recuperating. The company actually performed the best it has ever performed. We had the best quarter in the history of the company in Q1 of this year. And I wasn't there. I was there part-time in Q2, and we had another best quarter in Q2. And what it taught me that, hey, is as I re-engage into the company, I have to re-engage in a way where as the company is performing, my re-engagement is accretive. And I have to start to reinvent myself and apply myself in a very different way than exactly the same way as I was applying myself last year. And I went through this sort of phase where I immersed myself in some, you know, fundamental research about SaaS and how SaaS businesses are run and enterprise SaaS and how technology, and I can, you know, perhaps in another podcast, and I, you know, wrote a paper about it. And the way I engage with the company today is very different, and how I add value to the company today is very different than how I added value last year. I think I'm at a much more sort of higher level, and I focus on very different things. So, for example, I'm focusing, now that we are larger, more on analysts and external speaking in evangelism more, which I didn't do before because I was focused more internally. Right? I'm focused more in setting longer term strategy and direction than quarterly strategy and direction, which I used to do last year. Because the company sort of had learned and was performing, you know, fantastically in the areas that we needed to perform, you know, on that quarterly basis. But the direction that we needed, or the investment, intellectual investment we needed, is how do we take our brand and evangelize it externally? How do we talk to financial analysts? How do we think about our three-year product roadmap and three-year business strategy to get to our longer-term goals, as opposed to quarterly or annually? And sort of, you know, I had to pivot. And the most important thing is to understand when you are the value, or when you're doing something that you're not adding the best value you can, and take a step back, and that's the best opportunity to grow and to learn and re-engage in a different way, where it's good for the company, good for your management team, good for your employees, and perhaps most importantly, good for you, because you're a new, different professional. Wow. That has grown.
Sameer, this is really special. I mean, thanks for sharing these anecdotes. I think you have breathed life into otherwise dry SaaS conversation. Really? I mean, really? Yeah. Fascinating.
I think we are in a fascinating time in business. I think all of us should feel very lucky, and especially, you know, around the world, but especially in India, where entrepreneurship and, you know, the feeling that you can really achieve anything, especially in technology, especially in the younger generation, it's a very special time. And really, it's so exciting to see that, where India has probably, you know, become one of the sort of creators of the volume of entrepreneurs that India is creating is probably more than anywhere in the world. So that optimism and that ability to apply yourself and learn and grow, if entrepreneurs can do that, I think they can really achieve anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Final question, the final one, Sameer, for now. You know, you've been an entrepreneur before. You've worked with so many startups, large companies, and now you are building iCertis. What is in it for you? You know, people talk of exits, people talk of multiple things, but if we were to have this conversation 5-10 years, what would you have liked to happen, achieved?
Yeah. No. So we ask ourselves that. So is it the money? And of course, money is important. I'm a capitalist. If money, you have to make money, because that's what put, you know, bread on people's tables or chapati on people's table. You know, it sends your kids to school and you have a good life. But for an entrepreneur, at least for me, the thing that is most pleasurable is the lives that I have affected in a positive way, especially of employees. Where because Monish and I started this company, there are 1,000 people and hopefully many more in the years to come who have had such a positive experience professionally. And now because of what they're doing and what they're earning, they're having a wonderful life for themselves, their family, their parents, their kids, et cetera, they're buying houses, they're buying cars, they're taking care of their parents' health, they're sending kids to school or colleges or whatever. That creation of employment and the employees actually enjoying in the fruits of their labor being part of iCertis, none of that would have happened if Monish and I hadn't founded iCertis. And that is, I believe, the most pleasurable thing in entrepreneurship, where you see the joy in people's faces because they're part of something that you created.
Actually, very well said, Samir. And this is a great occasion to wrap up this podcast. But, it has been really enlightening talking to you, not just from product playbook point of view, but also the entrepreneurial journey. So stay awesome and stay blessed, Samir. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You too. It was wonderful being here. And thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to be on your podcast.